you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, Larry Rifkin and John Krofcik. And John, this topic that we're going to address in this podcast is incredibly important, and yet it goes under the radar for many.
And what could that be?
Well, I don't know. I thought you knew. Oh. Who knew? See, it's so stealth and it's so under the radar that you're two purveyors of America Trends. We don't even know what it is. And if we did know, we couldn't tell you. No, that's not true. We will tell you, and we do know. What we know is that a lot of people are saying, a lot of people are having decisions made about their life, really critical life decisions, and they wonder, how did they come up with that? So if I get rejected, John, for a loan, for a car or for a home. And I say, wait a minute, I thought I had some pretty good numbers. I thought I have this. I thought I have that. And I can't understand how they came to that conclusion. Now, you could go back to a loan officer, perhaps, at a bank or a credit union, whatever it may be, and they may say to you, look, we put it into the machine. We crunched the numbers, and it just came back that you were not a great risk for us. And so we have allowed a lot to go into a machine, a computer, using an algorithm that very impersonally and perhaps not taking into account various factors and made a determination that will affect our well-being and our lives.
Well, I think this is affecting us daily. I mean, just the fact that if we go and do a search, that because of other searches we've done, we think we're getting everything, and we're being limited to really what we're seeing. So we think we're smarter, and we're not.
No, absolutely. And these machines, you know, plotting and predicting with great accuracy our next move, our next purchase, who we're going to fall in love with. Oh, yeah, I've got a dating app, and this person will be perfect because of this, that, or the other. I don't know. We're taking too much of the humanity out of a lot of decision making.
Well, then you look at these airplanes now that, you know, fell out of the sky. What was it? The Boeing 757. I forget what.
737 MAX.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, all computerized, and it was a computer problem. And the pilots, I don't think were prepared for how to fly the plane.
Well, my college roommate, who was an airline executive and a navigator in the Air Force, said to me, and I did hear the report, that they never allowed these pilots to work on a simulator. And now there's one airline saying, we are not going to allow our pilots to fly this stuff until they have some time in the simulator. I mean, human beings cannot be erased from everything and leave it to all those smarties who program all these algorithms. Now, John, maybe I'm being just a little bit jealous because I was really lousy in math, and I'm going to admit that. So I couldn't develop any of these algorithms. But, you know, when we leave behind so many breadcrumbs so that people know everything about us. Now, we think these are innocuous clues about our wishes, desires. But these astute mathematicians, they can quantify things that you and I might see as very qualitative judgments.
Oh, no. It go to the store. Everything is designed for you to buy, and they know what you want. Even on the internet, they know what you want, and they know how to sell it to you.
Well, in Washington, they say if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. And in this case, when you go in and you think something is free on the internet, well, guess what? You're the product. And that's what people are selling today. That's what marketers are looking for. Give me information about human tendencies and behaviors so I can sell products to them. Well, Kathy O'Neill is one of those smarties a mathematician. And she threw in at the beginning, with all of this preponderance of evidence and working for a profit-making organization. And then she said, I've had enough. I don't like what this is doing. So she wrote a book, and she got involved in other pursuits using her many skills. But the book is called Weapons of Math Destruction. Now, I don't have a speech impediment, John. Math Destruction. How big data increases inequality and threatens democracy. And it's fascinating, John. You've been reading about it. I know I have. That a lot of this stuff can be used for good, but it also can be used for evil purposes. Now, in China, everyone's getting a social index score. Okay, a number that determines what benefits you're entitled to in that society, John. This sounds like something out of Isaac Asimov.
There was a show on Netflix that had that.
Exactly.
I watched, and this poor woman, she was trying to get her score up, and it just failed miserably.
Maybe it's on the new Twilight Zone without Rod Serling. Well, in the U.S., these numbers determine everything. The credit you can get, the job you're going to get, car insurance premiums, on and on. Worst of all, John, we really don't understand how these judgments are being made and if they're fair. And if they're not, to whom do we appeal that decision?
And how, now, have we already gone too far, and can we reverse this at all?
Let's talk to Kathy O'Neill.
All right.
All about it on America Trends. With us on the line is Kathy O'Neill. The book is called Weapons of Math Destruction. And Kathy, just tell people your background. I know you're a math whiz. Explain to us your fascination and your involvement with algorithms.
Well, yeah, I'm a mathematician. I got my PhD in math and number theory, actually. And then I became a professor first at MIT and then at Columbia, at Barnard College in Columbia University. And then a couple years into my assistant professorship, I decided to be, you know, to be an applied mathematician. So I got a job in 2006 at a hedge fund, being a quant, trying to predict the futures.
Well,
market.
I watch Billions, so I kind of know what that is.
Oh, okay, all right, but I don't know how Billions is set, but I entered right as the financial crisis was starting, so I never really got the heyday of the quant job. I just immediately saw disaster after disaster. It was interesting. It was disillusioning. I ended up thinking, wow, like these so-called masters of the universe are kind of dumb, but also kind of smart because they managed to like screw up the whole world and not really get fired. It was just like kind of interesting. So I left finance about 4 years after I entered it. I spent the first 2 years as a quant, the second 2 years as a risk quant, so like a thinking about how to measure risk and risk modeling. Then I left and became a member of Occupy, and I started working as a data scientist, which was the hot new job in 2012 or 2011 when I entered, and very quickly became disillusioned for similar types of reasons in the world of data science, where I was predicting, instead of markets, I was predicting people. And then I spent about a year and a half there before quitting that job as well and writing my book, which is basically, it meant as a wake-up call to the public, because I didn't trust, you know, the new masters of the universe in the world of Silicon Valley to, like, act reasonably, because I had learned my lesson. So it was more like a wake-up call to the public to say, like, hey, algorithms are screwing us silently. We don't even know it. We gotta start like waking up and put an end to it.
Well, your book is really wonderful, whether you're a math whiz or you're not, in terms of reading it and understanding what it is that Kathy's trying to warn us about. But I've got to say, there was an article yesterday by a gentleman, Navneet Alang, and it was in The Week. And let me just read this. The headline is, Algorithms Have Gotten Out of Control. It's Time to Regulate Them. And it starts, McDonald's announced recently that it purchased Dynamic Yield, an AI company it will use to analyze customer habits to try and sell them more food. When a hamburger shack is using algorithms to stoke sales, it's clear we have entered a new era. But the ubiquity of algorithms is not merely an evolution of technology. Rather, it represents the emergence of a whole new set of questions around ethics, bias, and equity with which we must grapple. To those of us who don't think about this, don't know how we're being measured and quanted and quantified. Explain what he's saying here and what you, in effect, are saying in the book about how this is all being used, this good math, and at what expense.
You know, the best, most exciting thing for me about what you just read is that I don't know that guy. I didn't know the story about McDonald's. And that's great news, because when I started worrying about this stuff in 2012, I really felt like the only person in the world who was worried. And even then I was wrong, because there were people in parts of academia that I didn't even know about that were worried, but I didn't know them. And now it's like a thing that you read almost every day in the newspaper, and it's much, much more of a conversation, which is exciting. To answer your question, the way I look at it right now, and I've, you know, gone through a bunch of different evolutionary periods in my thinking, but the way I look at it right now is, anytime there's like money at stake, there's like the algorithms will be there, will be proliferating, and they will be proliferating on behalf of the people that are, you know, trying to make more money. So bureaucratic processes that involve money and or power, things like whether you get into this college or that, whether you get this credit card or that credit card, whether you, how much do you pay for health insurance or life insurance or car insurance, whether you get this job or not, you know, whether you buy this product or not, or how can we sell you more products, all those things. If there's money involved, there are algorithms that are going to be optimized to make the people in power richer. You know, Amazon is a company that controls the supply chain through algorithms, and then controls us through other algorithms to figure out what to offer us and what we'll buy. And it's incredibly powerful. And as it happens, humans are really quite predictable, much more predictable than markets. And it's just an absolutely unending opportunity for these individual companies to optimize to their benefit. And the thing that I worry about, of course, is that last part, where it's to their benefit and not necessarily to the public's benefit, and often, in fact, to the public's detriment. And that's the kind of thing I try to focus on.
Where's the human touch? I mean, where has it gone? I know you open up in the introduction talking about an evaluation system for teachers in Washington, D.C., and Michelle Rhee got a lot of attention several years ago about some of her methodology. But is that a good example? I mean, where, again, is something about the capability of one human being to measure, you know, the effectiveness of something or someone? And who have we given that up to?
Yeah, that's it's a really good example of a certain type of thing that's very important to understand about the power that is bestowed on algorithms. Namely, they're mathematical tools, or they're presented as sort of silver bullet mathematical or scientific instruments, and therefore they are not easy to understand. They're opaque, and people basically math shame people into, and browbeat them essentially into sort of trusting this black box algorithm. Like in the example you gave with Michelle Rhee, what it was like a teacher accountability movement. The idea was to get rid of bad teachers, to improve education systems, especially for kids in poverty. And the idea was, it's the fault of the bad teachers, and let's get rid of the bad teachers. And the way we're going to find the bad teachers is through this black box algorithm. And essentially what that means is a number is going to be assigned a teacher at the end of the year to say whether you're a good teacher or a bad teacher. Nobody will explain this number to you, but it's sophisticated math. And unless you have a PhD in math, you won't have the right to ask questions. Now, this is what was explained to me by my college roommate, who was a principal in this case in Brooklyn in New York City. And since I am a PhD in math, I said to her, like, well, why don't you ask how your teachers are being evaluated? Ask for the formula and I'll explain it to you, because of course I'm a mathematician. And she said to me, I asked for the formula, but they told me it's math and I wouldn't understand it. And they basically, you know, shamed her into acquiescing to this sort of mystical power of the mathematical algorithm. And if that isn't bad enough, because, of course, one should know why one is getting fired from a job. I didn't mention this, but in extreme cases, bad scores would lead to firing or denial of tenure, which is tantamount to the same thing. In Michelle Reed's case, she fired more than 200 teachers one year, and I talked about one of those teachers. Not only
who, by every other standard that you can look at, maybe not that number that was assigned to her, was an excellent teacher.
Right, right. And that's what I was about to say. Not only is it an opaque and unappealable process, but there's reason to believe that it was almost a random number generator. The evidence that I've seen is that these numbers were very, very inconsistent, even among the same teacher for the same subjects in the same year. So it was just really almost random, and yet bad scores were leading to people getting fired in the name of accountability. So it's kind of ironic. It's called a teacher accountability system, but of course it itself is not accountable. It's an extreme case for the book, because there's many examples in the book where these opaque, powerful, unappealable systems are actually more accurate and not random numbers, but like actually pretty accurate. But that doesn't mean they're actually used well and used for the benefit of the public.
Does big data, I mean, when we're looking at it now and you've been really studying this, and by the way, the book is called Weapons of Math Destruction, M-A-T-H, just so I'm being clear about that, or I don't have a problem that you can't understand that. But does big data discriminate against the same people that society has always scrubbed as high risk? I'm talking about the poor, the dispossessed, the underrepresented, or is it even reaching more widely into everyone's lives?
So the way algorithms work, it's very, very simple. And predictive algorithms work basically by repeating the past. So there's patterns in historical data, and all you really need to build an algorithm is you need a lot of historical data and you need a definition of success. And you say, you know, in these initial conditions, did those initial conditions lead to success historically? And if so, then something like those initial conditions will lead to success in the future. And I know that sounds incredibly abstract, but it's kind of like saying, were people like you successful at this company? And if the answer is yes, people like you were successful in this company in the past, then we're going to guess that you will be successful in this company in the future. And if you look at it that way, which is more contextual, and you sort of think, well, what do you mean by success at a company? Probably people who got raises, or people who got promoted, or people who got good evaluations, people who stayed for a long time. You'll realize that there's a lot of human bias that creeps into those questions. Who gets hired? Who gets promoted? Who gets raises? Who stays for a long time? Has a lot to do with company culture. And this company culture can be fair or can be completely unfair. Most of the time when sociologists measure that kind of thing, they come out with, yeah, pretty unfair. So if you are measuring definitions of success that are inherently biased to the usual suspects, as you said, along gender, race, and class lines, then by sort of applying that algorithm and deciding who to hire in the future based on sort of past practices, you will find that you're propagating those biases. So you're not actually improving anything. You're just saying, well, if it happened in the past, and then let's
and carrying them
with
forward
that.
With a patina of objectivity that is now ascribed to them. What about the notion of Silicon Valley, where we have read and reported in the past, it's not terribly diverse. So the human biases that build these algorithms, or as you say, the past practice, they're built by people who have their own biases in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, like, what's really embarrassing about the current crop of algorithms is they haven't even been, nobody's bothered to test them for basic questions, as in, like, if you look at the facial recognition software, like, does this work well for black women as well as it works for white men? And the answer is not nearly as well, typically. And it's unfathomable to me that they keep doing this, but they do keep doing this. They keep, like, Amazon was the most recent one that got in trouble for this. They just keep building out, building these systems that just work for white guys, and it's not simply because white guys work at Amazon or that white guys work in Silicon Valley. It's because they don't actually have to ask these questions. They're simply blindly trusted because of their algorithmic nature. I just feel like it's almost like a religion we have right now that we have to get past. We have to get past this religion that anything that's algorithmic is trustworthy. And as soon as we get past that, then we're going to sort of set up a whole regimen, a sort of standard for what kinds of tests should we force these algorithms to pass before we put them into production. But we don't have those standards whatsoever yet.
Well, in the article that I referenced earlier, he's suggesting it's time to regulate them. How do we regulate them, and how late in the game are we as to reversing some of the dogma about big data, which must be accepted by many, many industries at this moment? And again, most of us, this is all shadowy and therefore perhaps a little pernicious to many of us because we just don't understand it. We know the impacts of it if we're rejected for a credit or something happens as a result of bad numbers, but we don't know, and we don't know how we even contest. Who do we go to get our own credibility back if it's being done in some black box?
Yeah, that's a really important question. And the problem is that we don't know what algorithms are targeting us and whether they have failed us. Like, we often don't even know that there is an algorithm evaluating us. To answer your question about the regulation, I mean, I've actually kind of just got there, right? I mean, what I mean by regulate, what I think people mean by regulation is essentially just setting up a standard battery of tests that every algorithm being used for a given purpose must pass. So, for example, if it's a hiring algorithm, there has to be evidence, strong evidence, that it passes all of the anti-discrimination law of fair hiring practice. You know, so it can't be racist, it can't be sexist, it can't be ageist. All those kinds of things that are in law are being ignored in the context of algorithms. And that's the kind of thing that regulators need to enforce.
Is it because regulators at this point don't think there's a problem, or that they don't understand it themselves, therefore have a really hard time even imagining what it is that they're regulating? I mean, when we see Congress at times interviewing some of the tech giants, the Zuckerbergs and others, I mean, they really are very badly prepared to handle this. They don't even understand this stuff.
Exactly, yeah. The answer is they are starting to be worried. I've talked to quite a few regulators. They are worried, but they have no technological expertise on their team. They're very underfunded, so they don't know how to do this. That's one of the reasons I started an algorithmic auditing company myself, full disclosure. So I'm actually trying to build tools for the regulators in large part. Mm. And I'm going to agree with you wholeheartedly that it's embarrassing to see Zuckerberg speak to Congress because, number one, congressmen and women don't, and senators do not know enough to ask him the right questions. But number two, he's lying to them. He's openly lying to them, and it's excruciating to watch nobody pushing him back. And when I say he's lying, he's saying things like artificial intelligence, which is to say algorithms, are going to fix the problem of fake news. And that's simply not true. It's not possible, and he knows that it's not possible, and he's just saying that because he is doing exactly to Congress what the Department of Education was doing to my friend who's the principal of the Brooklyn High School, which is he's just waving this sort of magic wand of mathematics and data science and saying, trust me, I have magic on my side. It's not true. And I really, really wish we could have a better and more honest conversation about these problems, because we're not going to solve with AI the problems that AI has created.
On the line with us is Kathy O'Neill. The book is called Weapons of Math Destruction, How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy. Following the housing crash, you said you woke up to the proliferation of these WMDs in banking and to the danger that they pose to our economy. Explain that to us.
Well, I think the first weapon of math destruction that I was really witness to was the risks scoring systems on mortgage-backed securities. And they, you know, normally scoring systems are like numbers between 0 and 100. If you're a risk of 100, then you're very, very high risk. 0 is you're very low risk. In the context of financial bonds and securities, it's a lettered system. So we had the AAA was the safest, and the AA, and then A, and then B, et cetera. And so you might remember, if you're as old as I am, that during the financial crisis, we were talking a lot about AAA-rated mortgage-backed securities.
Yes.
And the idea there was they were supposed to be super-duper safe. There was no reason for the people who were rating them to actually think they were safe. And so they were basically being rated safe because of mathematical dishonesty. They constituted a mathematical lie. So they were putting all sorts of crappy mortgages into these bundles and then sticking on a AAA rating as a way of selling their ratings, not because it was actually a safe bet. Now, it wasn't the only problem with the financial crisis, but it was a big, big problem. And it was a feedback loop of a problem in the sense that the more that people would be willing to buy these mortgages, these mortgage-backed securities, the more mortgages were given out to people who didn't really have the wherewithal to buy homes. So we had this kind of enlarged bubble that was enlarged in part because of bad mathematical algorithms.
Is this all an updated warning about what we used to call GIGO, garbage in, garbage out? Is that what we're talking about here in large part?
It's part of it. It's part of it. So in the case of the mortgage-backed securities, yes. In the case of the teacher value-added model, the black box for teachers, yes. It was garbage, definitely garbage out. It was random. In other cases, though, it's not exactly an inaccuracy that's a problem. It's just the way it's applied that benefits some people but not others, that's the problem. So if you think about Facebook, Facebook has optimized its newsfeed to engagement. That means keeping us on Facebook. That means getting us addicted to clickbait and false information and things that outrage us. And it's pretty good at it. You know, we are pretty addicted. We do spend too much time on social media. So it's not inaccurate, but it's not good for us either because it ends up making us upset. It destroys our mental health. And it gets us really, really angry. So it's benefiting them, but not us. And that's not a problem of GIGO. That's not a garbage out. It's much more like, you know, it's like a pernicious and destructive cycle of outrage that it's probably even more problematic than garbage.
This dark world of WMDs, as you call it, you say that we need to ask who designed the model. And what were they trying to accomplish? So, you know, who is designing these models? I mean, because if they were good mathematicians like you who had all good intention, or if you didn't feel there was good intention as a quant for a hedge fund, you said, I'm out of here. This isn't right. But what kinds of people are we talking about here? Because I think of mathematicians as some of the most honest people in our world, because they look at something that is very objective. They're not actually trying to bias things, but I guess that's not accurate either.
Look, I want to distinguish between true mathematics, which is beautiful, and my husband is still a mathematician, like, you know, absolutely abstract. It's really more of an art than anything else. And what this is, which is using mathematical people's trust in mathematics, but it's not itself mathematics. What it is sort of optimized, codified rules for manipulating people into spending more money. I mean, you know, honestly, that's really what, or somehow being otherwise profitable or, you know, to the people that control the algorithm. So it's not math. Mm-hmm. And to answer your question, you do have plenty of honest people. You do. I mean, the data scientists I know on the whole are super duper honest and they don't have bad intentions either. But they also don't really have to think about the systems that they're creating and who will lose from the systems. They really almost only focus on who will win and making sure that the people who they work for are on the winning side. So there's like, I guess what I'm saying is it's like an optimist's world, and that's not such a surprise if you've not been under a rock for the last 10 years. You know that in Silicon Valley, you think optimistically about the future chances. And you're not supposed to think what could go wrong. And so it's a kind of an extension of that. You don't really need bad intentions to propagate past practices. You just need to not think very hard about what propagating past practices is going to mean to the losers of the future.
I'd like you to give us some examples so people really can codify this. For example, when we think about the criminal justice system and predictive policing and prosecution, where race is taken into account and some of the outcomes that result from that, or any other areas where you think people might be surprised how much these algorithms and weapons of math destruction are embedded in the decision-making process.
Yeah, I mean, I'll use predictive policing, because it's yet a third kind of problem. So we've talked about, you know, random numbers, we've talked about biased data, but in the case of predictive policing, it's not biased data, it's missing data. And I'll tell you why. So predictive policing is based on the location of arrests, and the idea is arrests are indicative of crime, and so you send police to the areas where there's been a lot of arrests in the past, and that's where they're going to find more crime. That's the entire idea of predictive policing. It's pretty dumb. And it, in particular, it seems pretty neutral. It doesn't specifically talk about race. So people can think of it as scientific and objective. Of course, the problem becomes, if you think a little bit harder about it, that we do not have crime data. What I just said was we're using arrest data as a proxy for crime data. But it's actually a terrible, terrible proxy. I mean, just to give a couple of crime categories as examples, like we do not, most murders, like only 56% of murders lead to an arrest. So like almost half of murders never have an arrest attached to them. And it's actually less than half if the victim is a black person. The second category is rapes. Like maybe 15% of rapes are reported. And of the rapes that are reported, less than 20%, maybe even 6% will actually lead to an arrest. So just the sort of distance between crime and arrests is very, very large. But it's not just missing data. It's like the missingness is not equally distributed. So going back to race, if you look at pot smoking arrests, you'll see that whites and blacks smoke pot at the same rate, according to their own admissions. But black people are arrested five times more often, or four or five times more often nationally, over time, consistently, than white people. So when I say there's, and to be clear, there's a lot of missing crime data around pot smoking. Most people don't think they're going to get arrested if they smoke pot. So there's an enormous amount of missing data there. But the point is that the missingness happens more to white people than it happens to black people. So now going back to predictive policing, when you are using arrests as if they are a perfect proxy for crime, what you're really doing is saying, you're asking the question, who gets arrested? And the answer is typically people in poor black neighborhoods or black and brown neighborhoods. And so when you think about it that way, you realize that predictive policing is propagating an uneven policing cycle. So you have uneven policing in poor, minority neighborhoods, and then that results in a lot of arrests in those neighborhoods. And then you use this predictive policing algorithm to rationalize sending the police right back to those over-policed neighborhoods. So it's yet again creating a feedback loop, which propagates racism.
Is it fair to say that selling information, oftentimes these WMDs, about us, just all of us as consumers, as people living in this culture, interacting with it and giving people something that they can hold on to understand who we are, our propensities, our proclivities, because you say that predicting our behavior and selling it is the growth industry in the United States. Explain that to somebody who's never thought about it in those terms.
I think the best example is in the context of insurance. So if you are an insurer, if you want to sell insurance, that means, you know, let's say it's health insurance, just to be controversial. What that means is in the case of somebody getting really ill, you're going to have to pay a lot of money, possibly just enormous amounts of money. From the perspective of the insurer, what they'd like to do is avoid putting people into their policy pool if they have a high probability of getting sick, very sick. And so insurance companies are currently using big data techniques to essentially understand people's future risk of illness, and especially expensive illnesses like diabetes or chronic illnesses, in order to avoid picking up people that are going to be super sick. Of course, the Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, has sort of implemented rules that still exist so far that make it harder for insurance companies to slough off the expensive people. But, you know, if Obamacare is thrown away, then sort of my expectation is that the big data techniques that insurance companies have been working on in these last few years are going to really, really change the face of insurance. So all of a sudden you're going to have people who are sick with pre-existing conditions or even soon-to-be existing conditions are going to be priced out very, very quickly. I mean, we already know that pre-existing conditions will be more expensive, but my point really is that soon-to-be existing conditions will also be noticed, picked up by big data techniques, and will be part of your insurance bill. If you think about this sort of continuing as a dynamical system, because I think it will, then you should imagine that pretty soon sick people who need insurance can't pay for it, can't afford it, and well people who don't need insurance, you know, they can afford it, but they don't need insurance. So it kind of, the long sort of asymptotic limit of this, if you don't mind me using a mathematics term, the asymptotic limit of this dynamical system is that we just undermine insurance altogether, that insurance no longer exists as a way of helping us when in emergencies.
Fascinating. Well, I want to close with this. There was a headline in a local paper in Connecticut recently that I thought you'd be interested in. It said, "Blacklisted by algorithm. Computers weed out tenants with criminal records." And I'll just read a little bit. Fair housing advocates say a federal judge in Connecticut has opened the door to legal challenges of a practice on the cutting edge of housing discrimination, the outsourcing of tenant screening to companies that effectively blacklist rental applicants using computerized assessments of criminal records. So this is entering into all of our lives in so many different ways. So for somebody who's been listening to this and they begin to understand these weapons of math destruction, how should we read these articles and you know, these various reports that are coming out today? Are we going to see them with a great deal more frequency? And what should we think about when we see an article like this?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great example of how, and I'll add, I've been studying this exact issue this week for my new book, which is really about shame, but I think this is a form of shaming. I call it automatic shaming or automated shaming. It's even true when you are lucky enough to live in a state where you're allowed to expunge your criminal record, because it's such a well-known problem for people that have been in prison that they can't get a job afterwards, even though they've done their time. Even if it's a small offense, they can't get a job afterwards because they have this felony on their record. So there's new movement of like cleaning your record. The problem is that you can't actually clean your record anymore, like, because the data collection industry, the third party data warehousing industry, which is omnipresent in the United States, they don't expunge they don't clean your record, and they're often the ones that feed into these tenant algorithms. So it's essentially no longer possible for you to sort of know what your record looks like, clean it, be in any way a good caretaker of your own digital footprint. It's a real problem, and it's not stopping because we don't have nearly the amount of political leverage that would be required to actually change things.
Weapons of math destruction. Kathy O'Neill joining us today. I really encourage you to pick up the book because it's very accessible, it's very urgent, and it's something that I think all of us need to understand so much better than we do today, because it's affecting lots of things that impinge upon our lives. Kathy O'Neill, thank you so much for being with us on America Trends.
Thank you very much for having me.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network, mhnrnetwork.com.